If a man marries a second wife,
all right, let's see it.
He must not deprive his first wife of food, clothing, or sex. If he doesn't provide these things for her, she is free to go without paying back the bride price.
So before we let Tim go any further, we need to be clear about the context of this passage. This is not just talking about regular old marriage. This is talking about sex slavery. This is not just a regular old wife. This is a sex slave, because this part of the covenant code in Exodus 21 is precisely about slavery. Here's the context of this passage from the updated edition of the New Revised Standard Version. It starts up in verse 7, when a man sells his daughter as a slave, she shall not go out as the male slaves do. This is a reference to the verses before, which say that if a man sells himself into debt slavery, he goes free after 6 years of service in the seventh year. Now we're saying if a man sells his daughter into that slavery, she does not go free. And this is precisely sex slavery, concubinage, something like that. Verse 8, if she does not please her master, who designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. That means that the price that was paid can be paid back so that she is freed. This is actually the framework for the concept of redemption that we find in the Hebrew Bible. Why does God need to redeem their people? Because God has sold them to another enslaver. That's the metaphor for the exile. So redemption is God buying their slave back from the other enslaver. So that's what being redeemed here means. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people, since he has dealt unfairly with her. Presumably, though, he would have the right to sell her to another Israelite. This is only preventing her sale to a foreign people. Verse 9, if he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her as a daughter. If he takes another wife to himself, he shall not diminish the food, clothing, or marital rights of the first wife. And if he does not do these three things for her, she shall go out without debt, without payment of money. In other words, he forfeits the money that was paid for her because he has violated her rights. She goes free. She is no longer a sex slave.
First of all, when you come into these laws in the Bible, what you should never do is compare them to modern law. That'll just bad start.
Right? Yes, because doing that will demonstrate the social and the historical contingency of these laws. In other words, that it is society that dictates the values that end up in these laws, rather than these laws being dictated by some kind of transcendent, omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient being. There are no data that support any such conclusion, because these laws are very clearly derivative of other social values. In fact, these laws are borrowed directly from the laws of Hammurabi that come from over 1,000 years before the Covenant Code was written. And if you would like the best available discussion regarding how these laws were borrowed from the laws of Hammurabi, including how they were altered, you can check out David Wright's book, Inventing God's Law.
So God gave these laws to ancient Israel to set them apart from their ancient neighbors.
So that didn't happen because these laws were not given to Israel by some kind of transcendent divine being. These laws were borrowed by Israel from the laws of their neighbors. So it's not setting them apart. It is precisely entangling them with the social values and conventions of their neighbors. Now, again, you can check out Wright's book for a discussion of how they are altered in that borrowing. None of those alterations demonstrate any kind of transcendence to the way the laws are articulated in the Covenant Code. They are about social and historical contingency. The changes are to accommodate these Babylonian laws to Israel and Judah's worldviews and their own circumstances. Again, every single word of the Bible is socially, historically contingent.
And God, and these laws don't represent God's moral ideal. They represent God working with Israel as he found them after centuries in slavery in Egypt.
So there's nothing in the text of the Hebrew Bible that support this. If you read the narrative, where the laws come from, what they're supposed to be, it quite clearly is intended to represent God's moral ideal. This is why you repeatedly have God saying, you have to follow these laws in order to be holy like I am holy. But our morals have changed since then. And so when we look back on these laws, they don't match our morals, but they're supposed to come from the same transcendent divine being from which we get our own morals. And so we have to rationalize why the morals can be different. And we come up with this notion of accommodationism, the notion that God is just accommodating things to the different people, which is indistinguishable from the conclusion that we just made these up ourselves based on our own social and historical circumstances, and they serve the interests of each socially and historically situated group of people. And why do the morals change? Because the circumstances change, because the needs change, because the morals of the group change. This is why these are immoral laws that we see in the Hebrew Bible. It's not because God was forced to give them immoral laws because they just couldn't take it otherwise. That is a ridiculous rationalization.
And after centuries in slavery in Egypt, we find an Israel that practices polygamy, where men could acquire more than one wife. It's a very common practice. It still is in some cultures today, but way more back then. So God finds Israel as a culture that practices polygamy.
Except, again, these laws are based on the laws of Hammurabi that predate these laws by over 1,000 years. And also, sex slavery or concubinage and polygamy and all these other things are found among the patriarchs in the book of Genesis prior to this time period that was supposed to have passed in slavery in Egypt. So these do not represent God trying to accommodate this people that they suddenly discovered after spending centuries in slavery. This is consistent with what we find in the narratives that are supposed to predate that enslavement. This is another ridiculous attempt to rationalize why the morals of the Hebrew Bible and the morals of the God of the Hebrew Bible don't match up with our morals today.
And so what God does is it's as if, and just think, in ancient culture, patriarchal culture practices polygamy, which gender gets the short end of the stick in that equation? Right? Just give it 2 seconds of thought. If men can acquire wives like property in that kind of culture, they can discard them like property, and they did. And so God gives this law here to minimize the fallout or the damage of polygamous marriages. So that if a husband does acquire a second wife, he cannot neglect or abuse or deprive his first wife. Do you see that right there? Are you with me? So just stop and think about this. I know you wouldn't think this the first time that you read through the law, but in the culture of ancient Israel, whose dignity does this law protect? Just say it out loud. Women. Women. This wife. This first wife here. So it doesn't jump them ahead to 21st century Western whatever, but that's rather presumptuous to think that God ought to make everybody like Americans, right? So what God does is he works with Israel and he pushes Israel towards a greater principle of wisdom and justice, especially protecting someone who in ancient Israel would have been vulnerable. It's very powerful.
So being aware of the origins of the covenant code kind of illustrates the silliness of this rationalization, because the idea here is that God came down and was like, what, jackpot, my own people? Great. But I can't just entirely overturn all their social conventions and mores, because that's just too steep a learning curve. They're just not gonna make it, surrounded by all these other nations that are still embedded in those immoral practices. So instead, I'm going to introduce this divine incrementalism that is going to help them become more and more holy, baby step by baby step. And that way, we don't have this huge departure from the standards of the nations around them. And how are we going to introduce those baby steps towards more holiness? We're going to borrow 1,000-year-old legislation from the empire next door that we hate more than anybody else. And we're going to adapt and adopt that legislation in a variety of different ways. Some of it we're going to leave the same. Some of that we're going to make more just. Some of it we're going to make less just. For instance, in the laws of Hammurabi, debt slavery lasts 3 years. You go free in the 4th year. In the covenant code, it lasts 6 years. You go free in the 7th year. Debt slavery takes twice as long to get through, according to the covenant code, than in its source text, the laws of Hammurabi. There are other ways that the covenant code actually makes the laws more harsh than they were in the source for the covenant code. And so the notion that this represents God's divine incrementalism is absolutely laughable.
And so what ended this marriage? I think that's the principle here. Who ended the marriage here? The wife's free to go. But did that end the marriage? Is the wife leaving actually breaking the marriage covenant? No, what's underneath this is that the husband has broken the marriage vow. He has not done what he said he would do. And in that case, the marriage is broken, and the wife is free to go. So the divorce doesn't end the marriage. The divorce is just recognizing what's already happened in reality, namely that the husband has broken his marriage vows. You guys with me here? Because we're just explaining the first divorce law in the Bible.
Again, this is about sex slavery and the way that Tim is trying to accommodate this to a contemporary notion of marriage and marriage covenants is just twisting what's going on in the text, because Tim can't engage it on its own terms and cannot engage it in its actual social and historical circumstances, and is trying to make it sound like there's something good and right and moral going on here, when the reality is that this is about a man purchasing a woman as his sexual property, and it's just talking about what he owes to his property and why he doesn't have a right to get paid back if he neglects that property. This is about sex slavery, concubinage. This is not about regular old marriage, much less the Bible's first divorce laws. You have to situate things in context. Context is not just a magic word to make contradictions and make disagreements and make immoral things go away. Context is a responsibility, and it is something you have to be adequately disciplined to be able to apply competently. And too many people do not have that discipline. And the fit for this video has been The Dark Knight